Previously on Beta.
I love the way the chorus enters. You have the I will walk lead in, and those are always powerful when you have a lead in line into the chorus, and you have the doo doo boom with the drums. Check it out.
So we do a lot more than just fight fires.
I don't know if I want to get my IPAs from Kirkland brand.
And where would we even put that much toilet paper?
I don't know.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Lena Crowe joins us to talk about her debut novel, Fire Season.
She's like, if you have one con man, why not have an even connier con man? Somebody who's going to just show up and do all the cons way better.
Also, a little later, music critic Stephen Hyden on the legacy of Pearl Jam. He shares how one of the most iconic bands of the grunge era outlasted their peers and found new life by becoming a dynamic live act.
That's the reason why there's so many people that are committed to this band, people that follow this band around the country, because there's this possibility that if you see them tonight, you might see something you never seen before.
But first,
try to read a little bit every night, make it a habit, you know? The only problem is I fall asleep too quickly. Books are stronger than melatonin. Just get you a book, dude. It's about 50 milligrams a page. It's natural, it's fast acting. The side effects include learning. 8 hours, no problem, no problem. Put the book on your nightstand right by your bed, right? You wake up in the middle of the night, you see your book, you go back down. No, thank you. It's bedtime, bro.
That's comedian Sheng Wang from his debut Netflix comedy special, Sweet and Juicy. Sheng shows off his comedy chops with some very funny jokes and a personable, relatable approach. Whether he's talking about buying pants at Costco, his constant efforts to beat the system, or why he might be better off as a train, the jokes and the laughs just keep on coming. Sheng's fellow comedian Ali Wong directed the special. Sheng was born in Taiwan, but he's lived most of his life in the U.S., and he has great insight into what makes Americans tick and, more importantly, what makes them laugh.
My parents immigrated to the States when I was like 2 or 3, so it's not like I really understood what was going on. I mean, I think the culture shock just might be being a human being on this earth and also just being a child of immigrants, you know, in America.
I'm absolutely grateful that my parents immigrated, but as grateful as I am, I don't know if I would ever do that for my kids. That's a lot of inconvenience. That's a lot of suffering and sacrifice, right? Can you imagine? You leave your family, your friends, your community, you leave everything that you are familiar with, you move to a completely foreign country where you don't speak the language just so your offspring have more opportunities. And then your kid goes into stand-up comedy.
As you get older, you start to realize the culture shock and the whole dynamic of being a person of color in this country.
Right. Right, yeah. How did your parents react when you told them you were going to become a comedian, or have you not told them yet?
They don't. My parents, especially my dad, has a very strangely hands-off approach when it comes to life and life decisions for myself. And I think some people are surprised by that. But to me, you know, their idea was as long as you're happy, of course they want you to be financially stable and safe and healthy. There was not a bunch of pushback, I think, because either they want me to be responsible for my own choices, so if I ruin my life, they don't want to have a hand in that.
Right.
You know, I think if you look back and there's an upward trajectory in your career, I think that goes a long way with helping your parents come to terms with this choice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Absolutely. You open your Netflix special, Sweet and Juicy, by talking about buying pants at Costco, and you have some pretty deep thoughts about doing that. Can you tell us about them, about your thoughts about buying pants at Costco?
Costco is an institution to a certain extent, and it's just like a thing you kind of get to in your life where you become excited and become a member of Costco. Yeah, so, you know, I found that to be that was happening to me in my 30s, my mid 30s. We moved from New York to LA for that writing job, me and my partner, and so we got here, and suddenly we had a car and space and storage space, so life became more open for that Costco lifestyle.
Right, because when you buy pants from Costco, that's when you don't care anymore. That's when we let go of our egos and we begin our spiritual journey. Right? Because you hear people say stuff like, I'm not concerned about other people's opinions. I don't care about what they think. That is just talk. Until you back it up with the Costco pants purchase. That's how you let them know. He for real. He don't give a damn. For real. He wearing Kirkland pants.
Then suddenly you're like, this makes sense. This mm-hmm. pair of pants, makes perfect sense. It's comfortable. It's quality. And it's $8, $10, whatever. It's, I don't know. I think to me, it's just about examining your life and seeing where you're at and trying to find some meaning in those really seemingly basic everyday things, whether it's buying pants from Costco or doing dishes and having dreams of a bigger sink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things we can all relate to. We here at Beta are big Costco fans, and we affectionately refer to it as Keith Kirkland's, as if Keith Kirkland is the founder of Costco, even though he isn't. So I wonder, is making jokes about Costco pants kind of a clever trick to get Keith Kirkland to start stocking a line of Shang Wang action slacks, perhaps?
I would be honored to collaborate with Costco. Yeah, that would be huge. I think that would be a bigger achievement for my parents to see than the special itself, maybe.
what have they? They've obviously seen the special, though, right?
I think so. I think they have. I haven't been home in Houston. I haven't been back to visit my parents since the special came out. But they've been with my family, like my sisters and my brothers. So I think they've been around when people have been watching it. I don't know how much they've actually watched.
My mom don't even know what stand-up comedy is. She tells her friends I'm like a clown with words. But they're proud of me. My folks are proud of me. I assume they haven't said it yet.
I'm excited that it's on Netflix because there's so many subtitles in different languages, and mm-hmm. I think that's helpful for them, because even though they brought me here when I was 2-3 years old in 1980, early 80s, there's still a bit of a language barrier between me and my parents.
Well, I hope to watch the whole thing because they're missing out, because it's such a great special. You've been doing stand-up for 20 years. How has your comedic voice evolved over the years?
Good stand-ups. I think the goal of the craft is to try to find your most true voice, the most authentic voice, mm-hmm. and do comedy that is so original to you and so unique to yourself that no one else can copy or steal your jokes. Mm-hmm. And so that you are on stage performing and sharing what is true to your heart and having the most fun doing it.
Yeah, very well said. And I think you've done that, but I'm curious what you think. Do you think you've achieved your most authentic voice?
I think I'm getting closer to what that is. I feel like I'm always growing. I don't think I'm done changing and evolving and learning. So I look forward to getting closer to whatever that is. And I think that'll change as I change. But, starting out, I was a huge fan of Mitch Hedberg, and the comedian, the late great Mitch Hedberg was a very special comedian during that time when I was starting out, and so many comics adopted his sound and his feel and his vibe. And when you're starting out, it's very common for people, artists or performers or writers or whatever to emulate the folks that inspire them. But at some point, you want to come into your own and find your voice and your unique way of doing it.
If I have to print at home, I'm like, okay, we're gonna select the pages. There's no print all. Print all is for work. At home, we select pages. Double-sided. Grayscale. Lightest setting possible. When it comes out, it better be invisible. That's why it's so fun when you go to work, right? At work, you print fast, loose. You show up trigger happy. You ready to control P all day. You might not make the kind of money to live the life you dream of, but you can certainly print like you do.
I am no longer that concerned about whether or not I sound like this person or that person. I definitely do feel like I've got my own thing going.
Mm-hmm. You definitely do. I would agree that you have your own thing going. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because I thought there were a few jokes, especially the more surreal and absurd jokes that you told, mm-hmm. that made me think of Mitch Hedberg. But it didn't sound like they were imitating, or ripping off Hedberg jokes. It just sounded that they had that same sort of quality. So that's interesting to know. That makes total sense that he'd be a big influence on you. I love the laid-back cadence of your delivery and the way you use physical comedy. I think that could well be your USP, your unique selling proposition. Can you talk about the way you tell your jokes and how you use physical comedy in your act?
That's so funny. That's such a funny, interesting question. I've heard that from multiple people, them mentioning my physical comedy, which is so interesting to me because I've never thought of myself as a physical comedian. I think because it's on TV, people can see it, that element is more pronounced. Because I feel like my physicality is pretty minimal and sparingly used, I would say. I think it is. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I definitely experimented with that in the past. I mean, I feel like in the past I was a lot more deadpan, and I've experimented with it to the extreme where I would just like almost be a really weird presence on stage, just slowing down my delivery and my cadence. So I played around with that for a while, but it may be a little bit newer in my journey as a stand-up, but. I definitely have incorporated that to some extent in the past, but very sparingly.
Yes, you're right. It's definitely minimal. It's kind of, it's even on a bit on the subtle side. And I'm thinking of examples. I think sometimes when you're talking about typing something on, the computer or something, you'll have your fingers dance over an invisible keyboard and things. It is subtle, but it is there. And I think it really adds to the power of your comedy. You spent some time living in New York City, and while you were living there, you got an offer to do a show in Boston. What happened?
Multiple things happened on that trip, but if you're referring to the story that I tell, basically, I got an offer when I was in New York City, and I was just running around, just pushing myself to stand up every night. I remember getting an offer for a show in Boston, and I was grateful at the time for any kind of work.
They were going to pay me and cover my transportation. I got the confirmation for the train from New York to Boston. Turns out that ticket cost more than my performance fee. I got bummed out. Started having some dark thoughts. I was like, dang, maybe I should just be a train. Maybe that's what I got to do to make it. I know my nephew would be pumped to see me. Hell yeah, I'd be uncle of the year forever. I mean, partly why I do this is to inspire people like my nephew to follow their dreams. And the Asian American comedian, that's pretty exciting, but to be the first Asian American choo-choo train, that's trailblazing.
It's very common for comedians to compare themselves to each other. And in that moment, I was comparing myself to this train and how much this train was making. And I just had that surreal feeling of like, I want to be a train. I want to make that train money.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite jokes in that. Yeah, I love that.
Thank you.
Thank you. In Sweet and Juicy, you say that the time you get to spend with your friends' children is very precious. How so? Mm-hmm.
I've been an uncle for like almost, I don't know, several years now because my sister started early. But I just feel like I'm now becoming a better uncle, you know, a better, I just feel like I'm appreciating what it means to be around kids and their excitement and their wonder and their love. They're just curious and they will ask questions, and I love that about them, and they will point out things that they observe without being too cautious about how you feel.
One day, my goddaughter said to me, she said, "Uncle Shang, your teeth are yellow and your elbows are gray." I was like, "Good morning." I was like, "I think we learned enough colors this month. I think you're good. You're good on colors. I think it's time for us to move on to how to deliver news with sensitivity."
It's like Art Linkletter said years ago, kids say the darndest things. Yeah.
Right.
Your fellow comedian Ali Wong directed your special. What was your working relationship like?
She's a homie. She's a friend of mine. We both started comedy in San Francisco. So we started around the same time. And we've been kind of in the struggle together for a long time now. And so I was just grateful to work with her. You know, she's, to me, just someone that gets it because she's a comic. She's been through this process multiple times. She was pretty hands-off as far as, like, what the material was. She did help me kind of stop worrying about trying to make the special special. She was just like, just do what you do. And don't worry, you know, because I think it's a mistake that some comedians might kind of thinking or a trap they might fall into where they feel like because now that they have a special opportunity to make one, they suddenly want to change what they're doing and make it something different. Ultimately, she told me not to worry about doing anything different and just keep, you know, make the jokes as tight as they can be and as good as, you know, the best version of what they could be and just do that. And that was her approach, and that was her approach with the visuals. We weren't trying to be super experimental. We wanted to shoot a very, you know, seemingly traditional-looking special, just a beautiful red curtain, some lights, and a stage, and not do anything too radical. That was the idea. The experimental or radical part would be having me on stage telling jokes. That was it.
Yeah, and that was more than enough. Yeah. What's next for Shang Wang, besides the Shang Wang action slacks that we're hoping will be coming soon to a Keith Kirkland's near us?
I'm just enjoying this time. I'm trying to get situated, trying to find a good rhythm of life. I don't really know what's next. I think my main goal is to continue writing jokes and try to figure out what another hour would look like. That's really it. Just be healthy, be a good person, work on the craft, and try to live life well.
Yeah, and it seems that's what you're doing. You're living life very well. Shang Wang, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Sweet and Juicy. It really is sweet, juicy, and hilarious.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Comedian Shang Wang on his hilarious Netflix comedy special, Sweet and Juicy. You can find out more about Shang and his action slacks at WPR.org/beta.
If you're a person at all, you almost always find empathy for the people you're around, even when they're driving you bonkers.
Coming up, Lena Crow on her debut novel, Fire Season. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. At about 6 p.m. on August 4th of 1889, a fire devastated the downtown area of Spokane, Washington. To make matters worse, there was no water pressure when the fire started because of a faulty pump station. As the winds calmed down, so did the fire, but it was too late. By then, almost all of downtown was gone. Nobody ever figured out what caused the fire. And this lingering question inspired Lena Crow to write her debut novel, Fire Season. It's a riveting, propulsive story focused on three intriguing characters whose lives intersect in the aftermath. They are a banker, a con man, and a woman with the ability to see the future. We zoomed in with Lena from her home in Spokane to find out more about this mysterious moment in the Pacific Northwest.
I live in Spokane, Washington. And after I finished graduate school here, I worked for a summer as a city tour guide. And every tour started with a little history of the city. And one of the things that I talked about each and every time was the Great Spokane Fire. Took place in 1889. It devastated downtown Spokane, and it was really a pivotal event for the city. But a funny thing about it is that nobody can agree how it started. Like, there's no factual historical record. They know where it started, they know when it started, but nobody knows what caused the fire. So I thought that that was an interesting door to walk through as a fiction writer, this opportunity to tell a story that had no real historical answer. Like, it sort of made it like an easy entry point to writing historical fiction. And so I decided that I would try to tell the story of somebody who tried to make use of this fire to benefit themselves, but wound up not succeeding. Originally, the novel was just about, or it wasn't even a novel, it was a novella, and it was really just about Barton, and then that was unsatisfying, and I wound up adding in the other characters and the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm. What was it that wasn't working when you were originally writing it?
Yeah, well, Barton's not a likable character. He's not somebody who you want to root for, and I think that it's hard to have a piece that only tells an unlikable character's perspective with no other access point to the story. And so when I got through with having told what I thought was the story, I was like, this just isn't, like, why? Why did I want to tell about this guy, you know, trying to rob his own bank and then ultimately getting, doesn't work out so well for him. So I thought about who else could be involved in the story. And then that opened the rest of the narrative in a way that I think ultimately works much, much better.
Mm, yeah, most definitely. Barton's nemesis is this con artist named Quake Achenbacher. That has got to be one of the greatest character names ever, in my opinion. How did you come up with it?
I wish I could remember. I have no idea at this point. I liked the idea of having a character who had reinvented himself under the influence of an earthquake in some way. And I thought that the name Quake was cool, but that's all kind of all I can remember about that.
You did a remarkable job of taking the reader inside the mind of a con artist, inside Quake's brain. How did you do that?
Oh, thank you. I feel like he was the most fun character to write by far. And it never really occurred to me about whether or not it felt accurate, you know, and I think that's sort of the luxury of writing about a kind of person in a period of time that very much does not exist anymore. I mean, we're very much living in an age of con artists, but I think they're quite different from Quake. So he was a lot of fun to write, and I felt this freedom in him, but it is nice to hear that he seems accurate in that way. I think that there's just something about the human desire to take what there is to take that's very accessible. We all probably feel that to a certain degree, and Quake is just, you know, he's just kind of an id. Like, he sees things and he wants them, and he doesn't feel any compunction about operating with his own best interests in mind all the time.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Yeah, you mentioned he was the most fun character to write about. He was also, I thought, the most fun character to read about. So, yeah. Can you tell us a bit about the relationship between Barton and Quake without, of course, revealing any spoilers?
Yeah. So I had this feeling when I wanted to expand the novel and was thinking about who else's stories I could tell in this setting. Barton sort of makes himself into a con man. He's been a very respectable person, and then the fire opens up this door where he feels like he can get the better of people. So he's like, now I am this person who does crimes. So it's like, if you have one con man, why not have an even connier con man? Somebody who's going to just show up and do all the cons way better. So that's what I wanted from Quake, who's this guy who's going to be totally smooth. So he shows up to con the original con man, which isn't quite what he does, but he's Barton's undoing ultimately. And I don't really like a nemesis relationship, you know, when it's a pure, like, this person is against this person. So ultimately, Quake ends up sympathizing with Barton And there's kind of this rocky friendship, even though they are in an oppositional position the whole time they're interacting with one another. I wanted that complicated nature because I feel like that's how real relationships in the real world most often are, is there's a, you know, if you're a person at all, you almost always find empathy for the people you're around, even when they're driving you bonkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most definitely. We got to talk about the third main character in Fire Season. Her name is Rosalind Beck. How would you describe Rosalind?
Yeah, she is a sex worker in Spokane Falls at the time of the fire, who is a lifelong alcoholic, really sort of a down and out person, but she's also in possession of magical abilities that she's really been using just for her own survival up until the point of the fire. But much like the other two characters, after the fire, the chaos that it causes her situation forces her to make some changes, and she winds up using her magical abilities to ultimately, she becomes the ultimate con man and gets the better of both of these other dudes.
Besides giving us this very entertaining and propulsive novel, within that, you also explore the greed and misogyny of the American West back then. How were you able to weave those themes into Fire Season?
Oh man, I think that, you know, just as a woman in the world, I'm kind of always thinking about greed and misogyny. I think that writing about the era when the book is set and writing about it from a woman's point of view, because ultimately I do think, even though, you know, all three characters get their sections, Rosalind is the protagonist, it's impossible to tell her story without looking at the role that men have in her life and how what she has to do in order to live the sort of life that she wants, and how much easier everything would be for her if she was a man. You know, I feel like that's an element of the time that I was writing about, but it's also an element of now. It's an element of everywhere all the time. So, you know, that never stops being the case, I don't think.
I want to ask you about a short story you wrote called Sinkhole. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Sinkhole was a piece that I wrote a number of years ago, part of a fundraiser here in Spokane for a local community arts center called Spark Central. The fundraising event, it's called Lilac City Fairy Tales, and they did it for a number of years, where local authors would write these short poems or stories all on a theme, and they'd be compiled and then sold for this fundraiser. And so I wrote Sinkhole for that, I think in, I want to say, 2015. And then after that, it got picked up by Pacific Northwest literary magazine called Moss. And from Moss, it was then optioned by, the film rights were optioned by Universal and Jordan Peele's production company, Monkey Paw. So hopefully they're going to make a movie out of it, which is pretty cool for a short story that I thought wasn't going to have a life beyond this little local fundraising event. But Sinkhole tells the story of a family that has a sinkhole in their backyard. The sinkhole turns out to have this magical power where anything that's dropped into it reemerges fixed. And then the question becomes, what happens if you put a human into the sinkhole?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great story. And if my facts are correct on this, you got to choose who you wanted to buy the rights, didn't you?
Yeah, there was a bidding war and there were several offers, which was really cool, especially because I have no prior experience with film or television or having anything optioned, frankly. So yeah, it was a very exciting introduction to that world.
Mm-hmm. Why did you choose Jordan Peele and Issa Rae?
Well, I just thought that based on the work that they've done prior, I'm a big fan, and I thought that they were going to make something really cool out of it. And also that it would move the story beyond what I had written in a really interesting way, you know, because the work that they do is so different even from the genre that I was writing in. I thought it would be cool to see the story have a life so far beyond anything that I could have intended for it.
Mm-hmm. I think it will be indeed, because the story's something special, and you have those two masterminds working on it on your work. So I think it's definitely something to look forward to, and let's hope that it happens. Lena Crowe, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Fire Season and Sinkhole as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Deb. It was nice chatting with you.
Lena Crowe is the author of the novel Fire Season. Find out more about Lena and her collaboration with Jordan Peele and Issa Rae at wpr.org/beta.
I think Pearl Jam has always been pretty straight on and confronting grief and trauma in a way that seems very healthy, and I think it's helped to sustain them over the long haul.
Coming up, music critic Stephen Hyden on how Pearl Jam outlasted their grunge era superstardom, controversy, and tragedy to become one of today's most dynamic live bands. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. When you think of the great rock bands of the 1990s, who comes to mind? Nirvana, of course. But how about Pearl Jam? They've got to be near the top of the list, if not number one. Eddie Vedder and his bandmates made an instant impact on the Seattle grunge scene when their debut album, 10, was released in August 1991. The band has gone on to sell over 85 million albums and are considered by many to be one of the best American rock bands of all time. They were recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Stephen Hyden is a music critic and the author of Long Road, Pearl Jam and the Soundtrack of a Generation. In his book, Stephen makes a solid argument for why the band continues to be relevant 30 years into their career. At the height of their fame, Pearl Jam was never afraid to be different. They balked at mainstream fandom and used their weight to support social issues and to publicly battle with Ticketmaster's excessive fees. And their notoriously dynamic live shows are still global crowd pleasers three decades later. And of course, there's the music, which struck a responsive chord, no pun intended, with Generation X. Stephen joined us from his home in Minneapolis to talk about the legacy of Pearl Jam, how they became the band of their generation, and how, much like Batman, the band's origin story never gets old.
I was talking about the Mama San tape, which is a famous demo tape that was sent to Eddie Vedder, and it included some of the earliest Pearl Jam songs, and that was basically his entree into the band.
Bless you.
You know, there's three songs on that tape. There's Alive, Once, and Footsteps. When those songs are performed together, they tell a story. You know, early on when Pearl Jam would perform those songs in sequence, Eddie Vedder, I think at one point he jokingly refers to it as like their Nutcracker Suite. You know, I think he was trying not to appear pretentious, but you know, in the book, I end up writing a lot about The Who and how The Who was a big inspiration for Eddie Vedder, and how, in a way, I think Pearl Jam modeled themselves after The Who. And obviously The Who, that's like one of their big contributions to rock history, is the rock opera. And that was Pearl Jam's version of it. Although it's interesting because on 10, Footsteps isn't on that record. You know, Once is obviously, and Alive is, but Footsteps isn't. And in my book, I give a little extra attention to Footsteps because that's kind of the black sheep of that trilogy. And that's always been one of my favorite Pearl Jam songs.
Yeah, Pearl Jam's 10 is one of the most successful debut albums of all time. Its popularity was certainly helped by MTV's heavy rotation of the music video for their iconic song, Jeremy. You described that video as a scathing critique of conformist mainstream American culture. Why?
Well, if you watch the video, you know, it's interesting seeing it now because it's easy, I think, to roll your eyes at it a little bit. It's very earnest and it's very over the top. But at the time, and especially me seeing it as a, you know, 14, 15 year old kid, you know, you watch that video and, you know, they're showing kids pledge allegiance to the flag in a classroom, and then they intercut it with the kids doing the Nazi salute, you know? And it just opened up the world in a much bigger way, I think, back then.
At home, drawing pictures of mountaintops, where
it was still kind of mind-blowing to see mainstream society being depicted that way. You know, it really, I think, was one of the things that for a lot of people, it started you asking questions about the way the world was, and maybe it wouldn't have occurred to you to ask those questions before that. MTV made them edit the video, so in the original cut of the video, you see Jeremy put the gun in his own mouth. So there's no doubt that it's a song about teen suicide. MTV cut that image out of the video, so when you watch the video, you see Jeremy with a gun, and then it cuts to all of these kids who are frozen, and they have blood on them. And it confused the message of that song, where people took it as a song about a school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting looking at the consequences of that, because there are images from that video that ended up recurring in videos taken by future school shooters.
Mm.
You know, and this is through no fault of Pearl Jam. It's because of the censorship of the video. And I guess the idea was that they didn't want to show a teenager taking their own life. But in doing that, they arguably made it worse. Actually, not even arguably, they did make it worse.
Jam followed up 10 with Verses, and there are a few songs on the Verses album that showcase Eddie Vedder's empathy for underdog characters.
You know, what's interesting about Verses is that this is 1993 that the album comes out, which is really the time like when alternative rock is reaching critical mass. And part of the appeal of alternative rock, and I think Verses specifically, is that it is a confrontational album. And I think a lot of the songs on that album are about questioning different things in the world, whether it's, you have like police violence in a song like WMA. You have a lot of songs written from the perspective of women on that record, which I think is like was a pretty incredible thing for Eddie Vedder. I think even in alt-rock spaces that were progressive, it was still like a pretty male-dominated world. And I think Eddie Vedder, more than a lot of people, really wanted to be inclusive with women. I just wanna scream, hello. My God, it's been so long. Never dreamed you'd return. But now here you are. For Eddie Vedder, this rock singer, you know, one of the biggest bands in the world, to write a song like that, I think it really does show that he wasn't going to just repeat the standard rock and roll tropes. You know, most guys in his position would have been singing about, you know, scoring women on the road, or, you know, getting drunk, or, you know, living the rock and roll lifestyle. And here's this guy singing about, you know, an older woman working in a store and reflecting on her life. I mean, that's a pretty profound thing to do, I think. Hearts and thoughts,
they fade away. You say that Pearl Jam's third album, Vitology, is very much dominated by Eddie Vedder's diseased headspace. Can you explain what you mean?
You know, that record is so fascinating because, you know, it's an album that sold, I think, 6 million copies in America, and yet you have some truly demented songs on that record. You know, you have famously the song Bugs, which Eddie Vedder joked about making that the album's first single, and it's just him not even singing, sort of doing this drunken, demented call about bugs while playing an accordion. Bugs in my ears, they're eggs in my head, bugs in my pockets,
bugs in my shoes.
You know, you have like this 8-minute sound collage, which is reminiscent of like Revolution Number 9. But then you also have incredibly commercial songs like Better Man and Nothing Man and Corduroy. You know, Corduroy being like one of the most played songs in Pearl Jam's catalog. And, you know, when I was talking about his diseased mind, I just think that there's a sense of schizophrenia on that record. It's the conflicting impulses that I think were really afflicting Vedder specifically, but I think the whole band. And 30 years later, or, you know, close to that, like when you revisit that record, I think that's what's so fascinating about it, that they really walk a tightrope between accessibility and like chaos on that record.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. After the release of Vitalogy, it's impossible to overstate just how big Pearl Jam was and how important they were to mainstream culture. Then the Ticketmaster saga came, and you say that this effort is the single most misunderstood aspect of their legacy. How so?
Well, at the time, you know, they were really criticized for going after Ticketmaster because it really made seeing Pearl Jam live inconvenient at the time. I mean, they refused to play Ticketmaster-affiliated venues, which meant that they were playing a lot of sort of backwater-type places. And I think for a lot of fans, they were just frustrated by that. So there was a lot of criticism in the media for this, and no one really kind of took the long view that Ticketmaster was a monopoly. You know, we look at what they were charging for fees at the time. I think Pearl Jam got upset because I think Ticketmaster wanted to add like $1.50 to a ticket or something, which seems like nothing now, but it was big at the time. And Pearl Jam wanted to take a stand on behalf of fans. There was not a lot of fan support for it.
One second, guys, listen to this. This band has spent the last year and a half putting together this tour with only one motive. And the motive was to do right by you, that no one else in the business had done. And if you owe them anything right now, you owe them your respect.
They were trying to do something about it. This was like one of the only bands that didn't just talk about being anti-establishment. They took like a substantive step to try to change the system. And they were on their own and they got crushed. And we can see now that things have just gotten way worse since then. So at the very least, I would like to think that when people look back on that, that they admire the attempt.
Mm-hmm. The tour that came out of the Ticketmaster battle ended up being a pivotal moment for Pearl Jam. You actually narrowed it down to a specific date. It's their show at Red Rocks on June 20th, 1995. What is the significance of that show?
The show people always talk about from that summer happened 4 days later in San Francisco. And it was a very famous fiasco because Eddie Vedder had food poisoning that day. I think he came out. They played in front of like 50,000 people. Like Neil Young was there. And after something like 6 songs, Eddie Vedder's doubled over and he can't sing anymore. In the moment, it really looked like the band might fall apart.
Thank you for coming out today. We're sorry that Eddie got sick and couldn't make it for this amazing day. And if we can make it back at the end of the tour at some point, we will. And other than that, enjoy the day. It's a beautiful day. And be well.
But of course, Pearl Jam, in the long run, they ended up persevering and carrying on. And now they're like one of the only bands of their cohort that has survived. I mean, when you listen to the bootleg, especially like the first, say, quarter of the show, you really hear Pearl Jam trying to do something that is not them. They're throwing all these different things against the wall. They play a version of Jeremy that like cuts out the chorus, essentially. You know, the most anthemic part of the song, they cut it out. They try playing this Nick Cave song and they can't get through it because they just learned it backstage and now it falls apart. And then there's this song that I focus on in my chapter. It's called Falling Down. And it's a song that they only played once live and never again. And it's a beautiful song. It sounds like a song that if they had polished it a little bit, it could have been a big radio hit. And for whatever reason, they opted not to do that. So we just have this one recording. That just felt like a metaphor in a way for what I think Pearl Jam became, which was not this big radio band, not this big band on MTV, but a band that makes its reputation night after night. A band that goes from city to city and tries to play an honest, spontaneous show that's unique to that moment. And then they're going to try to do something unique the following night. And I think that's the reason why there's so many people that are committed to this band, people that follow this band around the country, people that collect bootlegs and they know all the trivia and minutia of this band, because there's this possibility that if you see him tonight, you might see something you never seen before.
Right, yeah. The biggest tragedy in Pearl Jam's history happened at a Danish music festival called Roskilde. Can you tell us about that?
This was a festival in Europe that had a really good reputation for not only safety, but just being like a well-run festival. In the particular year that Pearl Jam played in 2000, you know, they had taken precautions to like reduce the crowd size to make it safer. And it's just like this weirdly freakish thing, like where all of these factors come into play to create a tragedy. You know, Pearl Jam's on stage, it's raining, it's a wet grounds. You know, there was a situation where people got trampled at this show and, you know, a bunch of people died. I think it was 9 people died. You know, again, to bring up The Who, I mean, they had a similar thing that happened to them, of course, in Cincinnati and at Riverfront Stadium in 1979, where a bunch of people were trampled at that show. Pete Townsend ended up giving Eddie Vedder advice at this time. You know, one of the things Pete Townsend always regretted about The Who's tragedy with fans being killed is that they left, which it just seems crazy that a band would have played the next night. Townsend was very direct with Vedder and just saying, look, you have to stay there and you have to help the people get through this, or, you know, you're always going to regret it. I mean, I think it was probably in his character to do that anyway. It seems like whenever the anniversary of that concert comes up, Pearl Jam always acknowledges it. They always talk about the victims. I feel like a lot of artists would maybe try to sweep this under the rug.
So 10 years ago in Denmark today, it was 10 years ago today, it was a completely different experience. And it was it continues to be the hardest day in our lives. Everyone who was there agrees. And it's not like we're thinking about it anymore today, because it's really something we've thought about every day. And we just want to...
I think Pearl Jam has always been pretty straight on in confronting grief and trauma in a way that seems very healthy. And I think it's helped to sustain them over the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pearl Jam had a huge impact on Generation X. What do you think Pearl Jam's legacy will be to new generations?
You know, that's an interesting question, because I feel like Pearl Jam, I think the jury is still out yet on what their relevance will be to younger listeners. Is this going to be a band like The Who or Bruce Springsteen that younger generations feel almost obligated to listen to because they're so important to music history? Or are they going to be looked at as like a 90s band? I don't know the answer to that question. And there's a lot of fascinating aspects to who they are that are undersold that I think would be compelling to people who have heard Evenflo a million times and maybe they're sick of that song. But, you know, there's like a lot of other stuff to Pearl Jam that I think is compelling. And I hope this book helps to draw that out.
I think it will be the case, so... Stephen Hyden, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on Long Road.
Great, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Stephen Hyden is the author of Long Road, Pearl Jam and the Soundtrack of a Generation.
Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Shang Wang, Lena Crow, and Stephen Hyden.
You know how much homework I missed because of you? I loved your radio show. That was the best.
Beta is available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRbeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Just go with it, Steve. What do your instincts tell you to do?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
What Adam loves is the hunt.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
He is not Mr. Sensitive Ponytail Man.